Slowly. Okay, now we are recording. Thanks so much for coming, Joe. I really appreciate it. And Dr. Picard, thank you so much for bringing us, Joe. And just take it away. Tell us all about you, Joe.
Oh, you're so kind. It is a pleasure to be here. And I hope to learn all kinds of interesting comments and questions from the attendees from all around the world. Thank you. I'm Joe Justice. I'm the author of what is often called Agile Hardware. I'm called its creator by a lot of folks. I started a car company in 2006 that used all Agile methods. And ultimately, that company set 4 world records. And people who are interested in Agile, who want this Agile way of managing companies and doing work to succeed, love to use my car company as an example, saying, look, you can even make complicated road legal stuff with safety requirements in really short sprints, we call it. We would do them in 1-week sprints, design and build new cars. So it became famous, I think, because a lot of people wanted it to become famous. They wanted an example. Look, you can use fast moving Agile methods. Now that was 2006. Since then, Tesla became a radically high performing, extremely Agile hardware car company. And I actually went to go work at Tesla. And very interesting, the time that I was there, and I operated Agile at Tesla from the global headquarters there. The time that I was there is when Tesla's stock price rose the most, making it a very interesting financial time. And for me, that was so validating. My car company never became so big. It is still in existence, but it's a tiny little hobby company. Tesla's not. Tesla is by market capitalization, the biggest car company in the world, and by several multiples of everyone else. And it was very validating for me to see the exact same Agile that I was able to bring to my company, I was able to bring to Tesla, and see it compete at such a globally high level. So I'm the Agile hardware person. Now, I've got other interests too. I like martial arts. I like naturalism. I'm about equitable social good in a post-growth world. And I like to think I'm an intriguing person. But for most anyone in the world, they would say, oh, he's the Agile hardware person.
Well, I had contacted you. Thank you for joining us. I had contacted you a few years ago. I don't know if you remember, for my doctoral dissertation, which was on Agile security. And one of the reasons why I wanted you to speak to my students, so those are students in cybersecurity, but, you know, I used to teach project management. So, I mean, you know, I'm trying to bridge the two things. Project management is one aspect of cybersecurity. When you manage cybersecurity, there's projects typically. And one of the things that intrigues me a lot, and I don't know if what is your experience with this, is how do you do Agile in cybersecurity projects? Because the problem that I have with Agile is the philosophy for everybody that doesn't know it, where you go very fast to produce things based on the product backlog of what the users decide they want. Joe, please feel free to comment after I finish my sentence. The problem with cybersecurity is that there is those... Cybersecurity is kind of a very rigid framework, especially in the government framework, where you have instructions that say, you shall do this, and shall is not opened very much for negotiation. So I don't want to say too much. I just want to open the door for you to comment on this, and then we can expand. I know I have Chuck may be interested to comment on this. Please, Chuck, feel free to intervene. Feel free to go ahead, Joe.
I love that tee up. I'll try to also put 2 ideas on the table, and I think we can combine these in an interesting way to maybe get some fun comments and questions from everyone who's attending. The ideas I'd like to put out on the table is, first, something I learned from Bill Gates. I was really lucky to work directly with Bill Gates for a little while at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So we were working on social good projects, water, sanitation, and hygiene projects, maternal, newborn, and child health projects. And I noticed Bill started every single meeting, every single time, with how much of this can we do in parallel? And that resonated with me anyway, because I had a software development background. My bachelor's degree is in computer science. And object-oriented programming, or splitting stuff into objects that are decoupled, they're independent from each other, had become a natural way of trying to think because I'd been trained in it at university. Bill would start every meeting that way, and you can only execute in parallel when the things you're executing are fully independent. So they're not waiting on each other. They're not bottlenecking each other. And well, that's a whole other topic. By the way, that's the theory of fast moving business. Maybe I'm getting into deep water really quickly, but the Amazon strategy, the Microsoft strategy, the Tesla strategy is how does the company actually be formed of a bunch of smaller companies that are fully independent, whereas traditional slow companies that are dying off now have central services, like a central cybersecurity department. And then every project is bottlenecked waiting on the central cybersecurity department, right? Whereas these fast-moving, nimble, agile companies have those departments for every product. Every partner has its cybersecurity compliance group or person. So they're not dependent. They're not waiting. But I don't mean to get into that territory too quickly. We'll get there during this call about company structure, I'm sure. But first, it's how much can we do in parallel? Then second, agile, most of these cool agile practices like customers in the loop, working on the customer site, pairing, swarming, test-driven development, they're only exciting enough to persist if we're delivering something interesting in less than a month. I mean, really, we want to deliver something in a day, as fast as we can. At Tesla, this is really, really cool, I think, to a lot of people. I love being able to say it. It's about every 3 hours. Hardware in production and software in production changes right about every 3 hours. And so it's no wonder that company's worth as much as it is right now. Investors think, well, no matter what unknowns come, Tesla will be able to react faster than anyone else. So our smart money is on Tesla. And that is the justification, by the way, to most of the investor mind, is look how quick they can pivot. And it's about every 3 hours, whereas BMW is about every 3 years. It's that different, truly. So you have this agile idea of deliver something all the way done, tested in the market in less than a month. And the shorter, the better. But in at least less than a month, that keeps customers excited enough to stay on site, to stay engaged, et cetera. Then you have this idea of do as much as we can in parallel as possible, which isn't necessarily an agile idea, by the way. It's a parallel idea that I'll set on our virtual table here to talk about. Well, for something like a cybersecurity project, one enables the other. If we're interested in both of those things, doing work in parallel or having work done in parallel, not multitasking, but separate groups delivering independent in parallel. If we're interested in that, and we're interested in short cycles, less than a month wait time, even 3 hours if we can do it, those two help each other in something like cybersecurity, because we can divide security initiatives by group. Like, does the HR group have this level of security? Are we HIPAA compliant in our tax auditing group? You can split by group. Then, if you have enough cybersecurity professionals, you can do them all at once, if you have enough. And that's when cool agile practices like tribes and guilds and communities of practice and quality circles are valuable. They're not valuable, or they're less valuable if we're working on a more than once timeline and as a monolith, as one big chunk. But if we can cut the initiative into parallel executable projects, and then if we have enough people to execute them fully in parallel, well, you get radical performance. And that's where we're back at the company thing. That's where you get Amazon being worth so much money. That's where you get Tesla changing the way people think about energy and cars.
Thank you. But one question I have, I mean, going back to my question, if you work with Uncle Sam, especially the Department of Defense, you have things that are very directive. How can we work in an environment where, you know, the procedurals, the contractor deliverables state, you shall do this? How do you deal with an environment like that where, you know, you are mandated or you are failing in your delivery and your contract can be terminated, you can be permanently removed from contracting with the government?
Now, it also looked like Tina was about to say something. Tina, was it related? If so, that was a great time.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just thinking about my own industry in academia. I mean, if we could turn around a degree plan in a month or two, that would be awesome. Wondering how you get people to define their roles so that there is no overlap in efforts and that the different teams are actually working independently to come to a quick, you know, result. I just feel like we do so many things collaboratively, which is the reason it takes forever. So I think that's systemic in every industry is the whole culture and shift of not being involved in every aspect of a project, just staying in your lane and doing your part and, you know, streamlining.
Well, the trick, and I think this might feed the government industry topic as well. I think Tina, your point might feed Lauren's point. I'll see if I can bring those together. So here's what I think I've learned. Maybe this is fun. Tina, I think that you've probably been a part of coalitions and groups where people had their own research projects, they had their own theses to take care of, their own students to mentor, their own budgets to try to attract and maintain while they were part of this shared group panel. And if you've seen that, you've probably seen really slow execution. But maybe you've been so lucky to it's summer break or the pandemic just broke out or whatever reason, a lot of people's other projects got knocked by the wayside or canceled. And that coalition got everything done in a super short amount of time. Trying to make that happen more often, if you've ever seen it, is what we agilists call Scrum. It's the idea of a team that's not working on anything else, and everything they're working on, they try to help each other. We call that pairing and swarming, or mob. Mob has become popular. It's a pretty well marketed term. If any company is able to pull that off, so yeah, they're in one lane as a team. They've got one project at a time as a team, and they're actually not allowed to be disturbed, so much so they even have one of them playing a role whose job it is to keep them from being disturbed. We call that the Scrum Master. It's their job to say no to everybody. It's part of it, part of their job. It goes super fast, but it's that, right? It's eliminating the other commitments. Now, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
To the topic that Lauren brought up. Oh my gosh, thank you. I've seen this attacked two ways. And I've been really lucky because I did become famous. I got put in a lot of business books. I got interviewed on Good Morning America and USA Today and that kind of thing. I got famous a little bit in the agile space. And what that allowed to happen is when I was brought into government contracts, it was often at an extremely senior level, often with the people who update the law. And the oversight committee that audits them was usually also in the room because they wanted to learn. They had an open, engaged mind. They're saying, oh, Joe Justice is here. It's a real privilege that I lucked in, truly lucked into that situation several times. When that happens, you can say, let's approve agile process and write it into the law. And I'm lucky enough to have been a part of three initiatives where we changed the law to update fragile delivery. And that was the F-35 multi-role joint strike fighter, the F-22 multi-role joint strike fighter, and then one I don't get to name. And in all cases, the Code of Federal Regulations for the US was updated to allow an iterative there's another word I really want to use. One, iterative. Two, cross-collaborative. Three, I don't remember the word. It's where you start testing and deployment as you're designing. And there's a word for that, and I can't think. Concurrent engineering to allow for all those things and reviews and sprints. So that's one. If you're super lucky that you're at the top level, then yes, you can change the law. So, but a lot of the time, humans are not in that situation, right? For every 1% of a time that situation exists, there's 99% of the time or even more where it doesn't. So what happens there? The shalls can become backlog items, and we execute the shalls in series because then you're at least compliant, and we can ask for a variance. Doesn't mean we'll necessarily get it, but we can ask. We can say, may we have an agile variance? And the answer may be no, but we can ask. And especially if we're able to articulate what that is. Look, we like concurrent engineering. We like iterative engineering. Those are known good practices in industry with lower risk and earlier realization of value. We would like permission to use those here. We would like written permission to vary from the given process. And the answer could be no, but we can ask. Two, well, B of that, we can put the shells in the backlog and execute them in order monotasking.
So if I may, to remind everybody, Joe is one of the 17 Agile Manifesto signatories from 2001. I should have mentioned it at the beginning. I apologize. it's the end of the day, and I completely forgot to mention this. He pretty much invented with those 16 other people a methodology which has been determined in software development to work miracles on small projects. There is the chaos study that was made, and it states that on projects that are 6 months or less, $1 million or less, 10 people or less, agile, if I remember correctly, increases the probability of factor of success from 25% or so to about 75%. If I remember, I mean, I may be off, but it's the order of
magnitude. Yeah.
When this came out and the chaos study that studied the results of the agile came up, this has gathered a lot of attention, and lots of people are trying to bake in agile into everything. Remember, at first, it's a software development methodology which appears to be scalable to a number of things. It works very well in small things where you empower people. And one of the things that I found during my doctoral dissertation is that if you don't empower the team to do things, pretty much middle managers or senior managers are going to shoot down the agile team because they try to do things and they make decisions that impact everybody. If we take, for example, Purdue, let's say the person that designs the class or the team lead for the class would be able immediately to change the entire shell of this. And this impacts all of the professors, all of the students, and potentially the entire school. And it's something about power where potentially lots of people don't want to surrender this power. They grab it and they don't want to let it go because 10 people that are coding and not marketing, they're not managers, they don't have any powers, they're potentially, you know, just software developers, are going to change something. So it's very revolutionary. And I want everybody to understand that because it's something that if you're going to work in IT, you're going to see agile at some point. Someone is going to say, let's do agile because it works wonders. Okay? Joe, would you like to comment on what I said? I hope I said it about right.
I love what you just brought up for all of us, Lauren. Now, first let me be a little more humble. I did not sign the Agile Manifesto. I did not. Sorry. Now, all of those people are my friends and colleagues, but I came to the Agile party just after the Agile Manifesto was signed. It had already been signed. So sorry. I have been gotten to do a lot of super cool things afterwards with those same people. And I have signed the Agile Manifesto, but not that first day. It was a little while later. I added my signature, but I wasn't there. But I have since signed the Agile Manifesto, and I was one of the original creators and signatories of the Agile Hardware Manifesto, saying, well, how does this work when we're dealing with software? And then I would like to completely back up everything I thought I just heard, Lauren, which is that for small projects where people are empowered, 10 people or less, $1 million or less, it's really hard to argue against the known success rates of Agile. For large projects, there's a very interesting data set that you just brought up, the chaos report from the Standish Group. And for large projects, what the Standish Group found is they have a horrible success rate no matter what you do. Their takeaway was, don't do large projects if you cannot all help it. And that brought me back to how Bill Gates started every meeting. How much of this can we do in parallel? And part of what happened, whether he intended it or not, is you took huge projects and you split them into a bunch of small parallel executable projects. And then working at Tesla and visiting SpaceX, these are huge projects, like SpaceX, the Starship rocket. It's the largest rocket ever made by humans. Tesla, cars are relatively big, especially if you're trying to figure out how to revolutionize the idea of self-driving as one of the many features, right? Not to mention they're electric. And as far as government safety tests go, they're the safest cars ever. So any of those would be a significant project. So how does that work? Again, those companies take these huge projects, in the case of SpaceX, one of the largest projects humans have ever done, and they split it into a whole bunch of tiny parallel executable projects. So you're back in the small project territory. So here's what it looks like. The Starship rocket, it's so big, it's hard to even wrap your mind around it. I was lucky enough to be with them in person at the factory where they're made in Boca Chica, Texas. And what they really are is a set of about human-sized parts that are mostly 3D printed. Well, there's these huge sheeting sections that are welded, but the engines, for example, are almost entirely 3D printed. And they're made new every week. So the idea of I'm going to make my perfect project and massage it and get it perfect over the next 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year, these long projects, that doesn't exist there. It's we're going to try to launch this thing in 7 days or less always. And we're already working on the next one always. And so there's this rhythm that emerges, this rhythm of small projects, and they add up to be these massive projects. Well, there's another problem now. We've shifted the risk to integration. Will these small projects actually connect successfully? And there's a really clever process that's gotten a lot of good press in the last few years called DevOps, developer operations, DevOps. And all DevOps is trying to do is make a robot that integrates for you, that plugs everything in together and tells you if it works. And it tries to do that in less than 5 minutes. And if you really have a good setup, it tries to do it less than 5 seconds, because then you don't even have to plan much. You just try something and integrate. Did it work? No? Okay, because there's almost no cost when it's that fast. So you just try a whole bunch of stuff. And in 1 week, you've tried maybe 50 experiments or more. So the learning rate is super high when you have DevOps, automated integration. What that does is it takes almost 100% of the risk out of integration, because you can always just try it again. You can pivot, try it again, pivot, try it again. There's almost no cost to failure to integrate now. That means it's really cheap and easy to do something like Starship, which is huge, as a bunch, actually about 100 extra small projects, all of which take less than a week and all of which are executed in parallel. And I don't know how many people on this call know this. A new version of Starship is built every week in Boca Chica, Texas. And if you compare that to an even smaller rocket like the Ariane 5, which is a huge rocket, or the Saturn V, which is a huge rocket, but it's much smaller than Starship. Those are multi-year projects. Get it perfect. It's too big to fail. SpaceX simply says, we're going to make one every week. Don't sweat it.
Wow. So, I mean, wonderful. I mean, you explained this. It's beautiful. My environment, just so that you understand why I'm saying this, I teach for fun. This is what I do after work. My main job, I work IT cybersecurity. And, you know, while I have a background, I'm PMP, I did Agile. Again, my dissertation involves Agile and the psychology of managers preventing Agile from working and stuff. The question is, how do we bake in cybersecurity, mm-hmm. which potentially has some requirements that are mandatory, and you don't have a choice, you have to do those things. Because, I mean, functionality is great. I mean, I think Chuck wants to say something. Chuck, do you want to say something?
He's got some interesting stuff in the chat already, Chuck. I love what you're writing in the chat. Thank you.
About the 7-part rocket. Yeah, I mean, with 5 million pieces and thousands of contractors before, you know, the computers we have now, how they get all that to work at the same time is boggles the mind. I also work in the same industry as Lamont. We work together. Another thing that makes that much more difficult, there are so many checklists and so many steps that we have to check off to ensure they've been completed in order to move on to the next step. So how in that environment, of course, we're at the boots are on the ground stage, so our vision or the ability to change it is very minuscule. But from my level, I don't see how it could be done at the way it's implemented now, because there's so much structure in that. And there has to be, because at the end of the day, it's all about responsibility. If you skip one of those steps and there's a hack and somebody's medical information is stolen, somebody's responsible. So commanders are going to be very, very hesitant to approve a change that's going to increase the risk on any level. This is how I see it.
Oh, Chuck, I hear you. Oh, Chuck. Oh, Laurent. Well, I've got an interesting story that might be good. So I did not work on the Saturn V. That would have been awesome, but I didn't. But here's what I've been told happened. And looking back at the published history, I think it's true. So there was an audacious mandate, Kennedy, right? We're going to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And so you have an audacious mandate. And then how was the project managed? This was before Agile methods, right? This was before what we know today as Agile methods, and definitely before Scrum as a framework. So how did that cool thing work at all? It looks like what happened, and looking at the published history, it looks like exactly what happened, is it was cut into iterations. It wasn't the first mission, we're going to go land on the moon. It was, can we launch it all? And there were a series of failures. And their only goal was to get up to the altitude of space and then parachute down. Then, can we complete an orbit? Then, can we dock in space? So each of the, I'll call them acceptance criteria to get to the moon and back, like docking in space is one of the things we're going to need to do when the lunar lander comes back up. How does it dock? That was a separate mission all by itself. It was cut into iterations of each acceptance criteria. And here's the cool thing about slicing big projects into smaller projects by acceptance criteria. They're independent. And this is the second point I'd like to add. Now, interestingly, the space shuttle didn't do that. The space shuttle switched to waterfall project management, and it needs to do all these things the first time around. We're not going to iterate. And it missed all cost targets. From a financial perspective, the space shuttle program was deemed a failure. But the second piece that I really want to say is having way huge amounts of tests only helps if the tests are of business value, like business-driven tests, and they don't specify how the test can be passed. This is what enabled my Agile car company. I'm really lucky the Code of Federal Regulations is visible online, and all the tests to make a road legal car, and there are lots and lots and lots of tests. There's tests for theft preventions, how the locks have to protect you. There's the 50th percentile female airbag test. It says airbag test, but what it actually is a dummy that's half the weight of a 95th percentile male that's in the shape of a female doesn't have an airbag in front of the dummy. And the accelerometers in its head, torso, femur have to show it's under a certain amount of load profile that it would survive these accidents without an airbag, but it's called the 50th percentile female airbag test. So you have many, 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 many tests. What worked super well is none of the tests specify how you have to pass the test. They say, here's the dummy. It has to go in whatever car thing you made, and the loads need to be less than this or under this profile over time. But whether your car is made out of rubber or it's a giant inflatable helium balloon or you surround everybody with Play-Doh is totally up to you. And that's what enables the radical innovation and the agility. But a problem comes in where in other industries, sometimes the tests say you must use this type of material and it must be this thickness. When you've got those, there's no room left for innovation, or very little. You have to almost hack the rules to find innovation. That's much harder. So having a huge amount of tests actually only helps. You know what your scoring criteria is, as long as they don't specify how to pass the test. Instead, they specify how to conduct the test. Then you can do what Tesla did, automate the tests in-house. So you can try many different ideas extremely fast, and you're not bottlenecked by any external test agency, which, by the way, is part of Scrum. The idea that you can compile, you can test in the same room you're developing is an essential part of Scrum, so much so it gets a name. They call it the Scrum Room. And that's what these hardware companies are doing now, too. Now, that said, in certain industries, sometimes the tests don't give you that freedom, and that you're painted into a corner, you're stuck.
Great. Do we have any questions so far for Joe?
The chat is loaded. May I? So Robin cheers us on. Sounds good. Thank you, Robin. Edward, audio is good and clear. Appreciate it. Robin, again, very cool. Thank you. Tina, we have soft dev and analytics here too. So awesome. We can try to adjust analytics and software development. Robin, very validating. Do not use ambiguous language. Robin, love it. Thank you for cheering this whole conversation on. Ted, and Ted's been very verbose. Thank you, Ted. It's great stuff from Ted. Where sprints means sprints. Yeah, these fast cycles. And then Robin echoes, ouch. And Edward, wow, interesting. Robin, super awesome. Darwin Aguirre, how many layers of management are there? That question came in at 143. I think we were talking about Tesla at that moment. It's super flat. It's super, super flat. In fact, I'm lucky, I have a non-disclosure agreement with Tesla, but I'm lucky the employee handbook was leaked, so I can talk about it. I'm not the one who put it in the public domain. And the employee handbook is one crazy short. I think it's 1.5 pages long. And right in the employee handbook that I actually received when I was hired, it says, anyone can talk to anyone. You can email or call Elon anytime you want. And if anyone says you can't, they will be fired immediately. That's flat.
I love that. That sounds awesome. It would be so efficient instead of having to go to 3 levels of management to get the permission of the guy at the top. It's like, could I just ask him? I mean, that would be so much simpler.
I know, right? And that truly is how that company is run. And that company is worth multiples of any other company in their space. So clearly it works. But the challenge, I think, is it's a lot more comfortable to delegate down the layer of hierarchy. And so you've got to be pretty energized and pretty informed to take on the level of risk that direct communication implies. And not everyone wants to play like a superstar. Some people would like to be in a slow, sleepy company. The only problem is sometimes that slow, sleepy company gets completely outmoded. Like there's conversation now, has college been replaced by Ooda City and Tinder? And I don't know. Like, it's interesting. Lauren, you really want to say something.
Let me ask you this question. When I did my doctorate, one of the things that I studied was psychopathy, and especially corporate psychopaths. And one of the assertions that I'm making, which you know, I could not really prove because it's virtually impossible to prove, is that the more you go in leadership, the more psychopathic not psychopaths, psychopathic people are. Okay, so they don't reach. To be psychopathic, you need a level of 30 on the PCL-R scale, but many CEOs will score 20 plus, while a normal person, most people in this room are probably 0 to 4. So the question is it all of these people that, so psychopaths, it's all about themselves, because they want to control things, they don't want to let it go, and agile means letting it go. So doesn't mean that we need to pretty much fire all of middle management, pretty much, and senior management, pretty much, to just let people do stuff, which of course it's impossible. I mean, as if we were gonna fire every single level of middle management and senior management, it's of course kind of crazy what I'm saying, but what do you think?
Wow, what a fascinating lens you just brought up. You are an interesting cat, Laurent. How you've chosen to educate yourself, the mind that puts on your shoulders, that is awesome. I have a reaction, is I suspect the most agile top leaders of all time are probably on that scale, if I understood what you said, probably the highest scores on the psychopathy scale. But what makes this delegation, this release possible, is I suspect they're mission driven. So I suspect Elon Musk, I don't know, but I suspect Elon Musk would score the highest possible score on the psychopathy metric.
You appear very I didn't score him, I didn't try, but you know, based on what we know, he would probably score 20 or more, probably.
So this may be true, and if it is, what allows a person like this to do radical levels of delegation? And I think it's truly, I believe there's something quite different about Elon's ethics that he would, I believe he would die immediately if it meant all the rest of humanity and life becomes multiplanetary and endures longer. The light of consciousness perpetuates. I actually think that's true. So he may, I will guess, Elon Musk may think his life is the most precious thing ever because he's trying to achieve something greater than Elon Musk's life. And I think that's why Elon Musk, my theory, why Elon Musk engages in radical delegation. And I will suppose that could be true of many projects. My most successful project that was my own, I had radical successes at Tesla, but my most successful project that was my own was Wikispeed, the car company. And at that time, I truly believed I was saving the world. I was helping show that ultra efficient vehicles were not only possible, they could be cool. And I was trying to disrupt what I thought was a vicious cycle of pollution. And I thought that was bigger than myself. That enabled me to feel very comfortable with stupendous levels of delegation. Well, not even delegation, of freedom and direct contact. Now, what also saved my bacon is automated tests. It's a lot more comfortable to say, hey, you take this and run with it. Here's your test that in 5 seconds or less tells you if what you're doing is better or worse than what we already had. Way better than, hey, you take this and run with it. Use your best judgment as to whether you're making progress or not, right? There's a lot more risk of ineffective use of funds or even malicious behavior, right? So the test-driven development aspect, that the DevOps, what's become DevOps, saved my bacon many times.
Okay, wonderful. So if you don't mind, Joe, let's change completely topic from, you know, talking about what agile is, what works and doesn't work and stuff. Let's be a little bit more academic here for a few minutes, if you don't mind. So I have all of these students. So, you know, we teach at Purdue, we teach project management, we teach agile, we teach all of this good stuff. What advices would you give to my students if they're interested by an agile framework mindset to get into this and potentially, you know, have a career and make big bucks, because everybody wants big bucks, right?
Sure, sure. Well, and big bucks are fully possible while being socially equitable. I don't know how many people have that hang up in their mind, but I do. It turns out there's enough currency for everyone alive to have $1 million US. So don't feel bad. How can I say it? I have a social justice complex. So is it okay for me to be affluent? I think yes, because it can still be equitable. Oh, okay, so with that hurdle cleared, maybe. I've got two tips that are both highly controversial, and I very much believe in both. So at least from my opinion, I'm happy to try to justify them. But I'll admit these are going to be charged, but I believe they work. So I'll answer your question from my perspective. One, go join a Musk company. Really do that. You'll, and I'm not saying Musk companies, Elon Musk companies are the only successful place, but they're easy to find. They're all over the world now. And they are one of the companies that are the real deal. And I would say try to last at least 30 days. Tips on that is it's very much like running a marathon. It's 12-hour shifts, no matter what your role is. There's no comfortable office job. Everyone will be lifting heavy things and using machinery. Everyone, no matter if you were hired for project management or what, you will be doing things. It's cross-functional. So I'd say figure out your sleep schedule. Tell all your friends you're going to disappear from the face of the earth for a while. It's like joining a pro sports team. You're going to have a diet regimen. You're going to have a sleep regimen. You're going to have stretches in the morning before your shift and stretches after. Like you're joining a pro sport. And I'd say try to last at least 30 days. Don't think you're going to do anything else while you're there. Don't plan to write a book while you're there. Don't plan to do anything while you're there. Try to last at least 30 days and journal every night, and last as long as you can. You now will intuitively know what this real thing is, this agile movement, because you've seen it, you've done it, you've seen the edge cases, you've got it. Now you can go do anything with extremely high level of execution. You understand it, and you can see through the mystery in words, and in a book you can pick out the weirdness and see right to the part that works. You've got it. It's like you're surrounded by people who have read books on how to dance ballet for the last 30 years, and then you actually go dance for a month. And no one else did. Like it's like, well, now okay. But you just get it. So that's tip one. And then start your own company, because it's way easier to start your own company than to try to convince existing layers of management. And the only thing that effectively convinces existing layers of management is sincere and capable competition. So do yourself a favor and be that sincere and capable competition, and have a tremendous amount of fun and self-respect while you do it. Do it in a healthy way. Don't overwork, but crush it. Use those methods you learn and sleep healthily, eat healthily, have a lot of fun and crush it. And that will transform those other companies, because they'll come ask you to join their board and help them fix their problem. That's what happened to me. And that's my living now. And it's great. Then related to that, invest in Tesla stock. That's super controversial. It's at an all-time high. What's this Joe saying? What's this Joe person saying? Nothing convinced me more than actually working in that company. Like right now, Tesla is valued high as a car company. They're not a car company. They're an energy company. And if you add all the energy company stock to all the automotive company stock, you're still not touching the boring company, which is trying to be essentially the equivalent of bridge building and infrastructure and highway companies. They're trying to replace all of that with tunnels. So you add all the money there. Well, SpaceX, not directly under Tesla stock, but related, is attempting to disrupt all telecommunications. You take the total stock value of AT&T, of T-Mobile, of Deutsche Telekom, of KDDI, of SoftBank, and that's still what Tesla is aiming to eat. They've got so far to grow. In this person's opinion, they're trading at what, like $640 a share today, something around that range. I mean, it's highly volatile. They're going to split several more times, but it'll be the equivalent of 10,000 a share or more is easily the target of that company. So I would say put as much money as you can possibly afford to lose, because I mean, the world's governments could all band against Musk and try Elon for war crimes or something and execute him. I mean, something could happen. Government could intervene. But as long as the free market reigns, there's nothing stopping that freight train. So I'd say backtrack what it takes for you to have enough money that you have complete and total freedom. You can do what you think is responsible and lovely and decide that's how much you set aside for Tesla stock. Put it into Tesla stock. So when it hits that level, you now have complete and total financial freedom to live your best life and make the world a better place. Then in the meantime, make your company that is making the better life you want.
Absolutely there for Tesla. I mean, they're worth $500 billion. They may go up to $2 trillion like Apple. It's an upswing of four. Is it going to go much more than that? I could see if he did his boring company, I could see boring company going up. Yes, because, I mean, I looked at it. The idea has potentially, some merit. SpaceX company is probably worth $100 billion. Yes, but Tesla, I mean, at most I can see an upswing of 4 or 5. Anyway,
and I respect alternate views. So for everyone watching, there are alternate views. Clearly, there's not complete synonymous advice on the line. Please use your own good judgment. Thank you, Lauren.
So Ted asked a question about the boring company. They actually don't dig down. They dig sideways and then horizontal. They don't dig straight down. They go sideways, straight, and then sideways. So and they have an agile framework, actually, because the idea is to dig most things in like under a week. So they are a perfect example of agile, actually, where they want to do things super fast as opposed to the typical tunnel companies that last months, years. Them, they want to be in and out in a week or under. Right, Joe?
That is also my understanding. I did see the first Hyperloop test track, and it runs alongside SpaceX Hawthorne campus. And what shocked me about that, I wonder if I can actually convey this. I'm going to try. So it's this long, 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 long tube. So you can shoot a pod down it at multiples of the speed of sound in theory, right? It's crazy fast transportation. Well, there's so much gelled up in this. You're going next to this long, 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 long tube. And this one's above ground because it's the test loop. So they can easily access all parts of it. There's underground tunnels too, but the first one is above ground. So you can go along next to it. Well, there's cross streets, right? Because it's above ground. There's like railroad crossings. And then those sections of the tube are on a hinge and they just swing out of the way. So the road continues. Let me try to gel what that means. A traditional way of viewing this is, where in the world can we get the length of land to run these tests? And then can we truck our goods out to this location to run tests? Well, for a company like SpaceX, how fast you can go from the idea lab with a new idea to tested is the entire name of the game. That's your feedback loop. So the test has to be co-located with the design and fabrication. It has to. Anything else is too slow. Like, that's a tenet of Scrum, right? So there's no choice but to lay it over Los Angeles. Well, there just aren't super long stretches of Los Angeles without roads. So of course we're going to build it in modules and just swing them out of the way. And we'll have a regular cadence of variances to shut down these side roads, so we can shoot pods at crazy fast speeds right across traffic, basically. But you have these railroad ties and cones. I'm not sure if if how absolutely sensical that is because of what the priority is. The priority is speed of, like, no other company would do that. No one. They would get a huge area in the desert, a 3-hour flight from anywhere. And once a year, once every 3 years, they drive a huge convoy out there to test in batch. That's what everyone else would do. In fact, that's what everyone else did. But that breaks the speed of iteration. So SpaceX couldn't. So you have this completely unconventional solution. It's ridiculous. And also it's super cheap. It's super, super, super cheap. Like the lack of cost is astonishing. They're like, well, we'll just string it across the road and swing it out of the way on a hinge. I mean, it's like a great big door hinge. Like a lot of the parts come from Home Depot. It's so low cost, and they're totally changing the world. So that, I'd like to share that.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for Joe?
Ted writes, not going to say it doesn't sound like fun. Oh, thank you, Ted. So the Boring Company does cut shafts, but their primary implements are all the horizontal stuff, because they cut the shaft with traditional tools. I mean, they're trying to innovate those too, but the vast majority of the innovation is the vast length. And so they lower down into the shaft then the thing they're agilely experimenting on, and that tunnels sideways. Yeah, but they do cut a shaft, but that's a different tool set.
And it's for air.
For access, so they can lower the boring machine down. They lower it.
And there was something that is very interesting about the Boring, since we're speaking about the Boring Company. Let me skip it.
Oh, you're great, Laura. You're great. Oh, thank you.
No. Hold on.
Are you okay, buddy? Are you okay? Turn your camera up. Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm sorry, I'm laughing. But what they found is that the tunnels in Los Angeles during the earthquakes, Los Angeles has subway, and subway underground during the earthquakes was not actually impacted. So the Boring Company apparently seems to be a perfect solution for Los Angeles, where they could dig, and if there's an earthquake, it would not be the end of the world, which is very surprising. So,
apparently, earthquakes, the primary damaging factor of earthquakes is a surface phenomena. I didn't know that, but I mean, hey, we're all continuing to learn.
Yeah.
Oh, here's a question.
The higher you are, the more you feel it. So if you're in the tower on the 24th floor, then you feel it, while you may not feel it on the ground level.
Ted writes, so in applying agile operations to a company that's not currently working within the framework, there've got to be many obstacles. Employing employees, including C-level, who aren't entirely on board or think they're excluded, how do you work through those challenges? First, you asking permission, if you get it, is super gonna help, because then you've got this waiver. You're at least upfront. You're saying, within this bounded area, within this project, may I have a waiver? May I have an agile waiver? And then the potential naysayers aren't viewing you as a loose cannon. They're viewing you as a valuable experiment to push the innovation level of the company. So that doesn't hurt. But I'll sandwich that with what's called undercover Scrum. And that's where you delegate a member of your group, or we take turns usually, where someone at any given time, their job is to create the traditional project plan, milestones, the stuff that looks like we're doing traditional management, to hide the fact that everyone's agile inside. And yes, that can go horribly wrong if you're found out, but it happens all the time. That's called undercover Scrum. Oh, Ted, social engineering, bingo. Ted, you're great. Thank you for the awesome comments all through this. So those two, yes. Yes, yes, and yes.
Ted is definitely one of our more entertaining students. Thank you, Ted. But I agree. I mean, I have the same question and problem. I mean, if I were to tell my leadership in the next three levels up, we're going to do it differently this time, they'd be like, yeah, no. And so I agree, you know, the undercover scrum might be the way to go. You know, for the for something that's delegated to my area anyway, I could probably get away with then doing the scrum methodology within my, you know, area of expertise or control, I guess. But and then we can prove how quickly we could turn it around. I mean, I think we have proven that to some extent with the things that we've done, that, you know, our leadership right now came from a very structured, traditional environment, university, and we have always been a little bit different. And so I think they were already kind of impressed with how quickly we can turn things around and how agile we actually are, even though for us, you know, 4 months to do a course is agile, because there, you know, in the previous university, it took 2 years. So yeah. 4 months is a good time frame for them. But for us, it'd be like, you know, 30 days or less would be awesome. So. But anyway, I can definitely sympathize with Ted. It's like, how do you get the C-suite on board?
So CCB is an agile. Thoughts on that?
Wait, what just happened?
CCBs and agile. What are your thoughts on that? Change control boards. Change.
Oh yeah.
Can you change boards pretty much?
Well, every time we change the product backlog, that's what I'll call the to-do list, right? The project plan. I'll call that the project backlog. Every time we change that, that is change management, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the fastest change management is real time as new information comes in. How do you make that responsible? Scrum's plan of attack is they give it a role who's highly trained. We call it the product owner, and they are accountable for change management. Change management is essentially delegated to this one person. Now they have stakeholders that they need to keep updated, but this one person has the decision, and they're highly trained and they have an agreement. They say, I can change stuff in real time and spend money, all kinds of things. I mean, they're a super powerful role, but only within this scope. And that scope is what's called the definition of ready. Something is ready for the backlog to be considered by the product owner only if it meets the definition of ready. Now, the definition of ready in pure play agile companies is quite broad. The product owner has a lot of lateral action. In companies with a more traditional hierarchical bureaucratic structure who's trying some scrum, there may be a super narrow definition of ready. And it's, yes, product owner, you are the change control board. We've agreed to that, but only if you don't spend more than this X approved budget over the course of the entire year. You can change what it's spent on, but it's a radical variance if you go outside these financial bounds. The solutions that you're allowed to spend the money on must be, well, let's say cybersecurity compliance initiatives. You can't start making apps, even if you think it's a really good idea, or whatever the bounds are. Now, in a company like Facebook, for example, or Amazon, the definition of ready is almost zero. It's like, do good work and don't be evil, because they radically empower these people. And innovation is prized over almost anything else. Again, the reason that's almost responsible is because how many automated tests run so quickly? So you know really quickly if you're going off the rails. Now, I have a question. I would like to see existing in the world a Masters of Business Agility. Boston University has asked me to consult on creating that program. I would like to see many universities experiment with developing that, and I would love to help. So my question is, does anyone think it would be cool if Purdue moved towards offering a Master's of Business Agility?
I think it's a great idea. I oversee the IT area, so it would have to be an IT degree. But no, we do. I mean, the other side of my school is business, the MBA program and all that kind of stuff. So we could certainly consider that. I, if nothing else, there should be at least a concentration in that skill set. You know, right now we have Agile a little bit on our software development side, not really on the business side, just very slightly in a course here and there. But yeah, that's an interesting idea. I'll definitely make a note of that and keep in contact with you. I will ask for your assistance. Yes.
Were you in contact with Vijay Kanabar, Joe?
I might not be. Can we fix that?
I could try to find his email. I think I still have it. I used to teach at BU.
Oh yeah. I'm primarily collaborating with Jim Hannon there. Do you remember Jim? He's newer because they've got this Agile lab now. He's brought in from the outside to run the Agile lab. Oh, don't we have another meeting now? We are at time. You are all fantastic. I can't wait to watch the recording and cheer us all on, laugh at and with ourselves.
You totally did great. You are totally great. We do have another meeting now. That's what I was just typing in the chat. Thank you so much for your time. We do have a cybersecurity club come after this. Just so happens it's the third Tuesday of the month. But I think I love your idea, and I will definitely bring that forward. We're in a growth mode and have a long list of possible programs, and I can put that one on the list. But thank you.
Joe, thank you for attending. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. And I'll send out the link for the podcast so you can see that when it's done, Joe.
Thanks so much, everyone. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye-bye. Have a great night, everyone. Talk to you soon.